thank you for joining us for today's Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. Today in studio, I have with me Jerry Goodspeed, USU Horticulture Extension Agent, and we're going to talk about mint. Now, I asked you before the program which one, and you said that, you know, basically it doesn't matter. So let's talk about mint.
Well, a lot of them like the spearmint and the peppermints. You know, I grew up in the Northwest, and we grew mint as a crop where you would harvest it and you would extract the juice off of it. And it's a very profitable product at times. And one of the reasons it's very profitable is because to get what they would do to fill an acre or 100 acres, whatever it was, of mint is you take the plant and you just rip it all apart and then you just throw down any of the roots in the soil wherever you want to. And then pretty soon where you threw down the roots, you have 1, 2, 10, 50 plants. And so it fills in that area really nice. And that's great if you're trying to grow mint. It's not so great if you're a homeowner and you've planted some mint in your herb garden and pretty soon the mint's starting to overtake some of your other herbs. And so normally what we do is before you put it in the ground, put a container around it. And then put it in the ground or keep it in the container so that it stays in a small area and it doesn't start to invade everything else, especially the peppermints and the spearmints and those types of things.
Now, about 10 years ago, I got all excited about growing different herbs and things. And so I got these mints with different sounding names like chocolate mint. And yep. It does kind of has this chocolate smell, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I got the peppermint. I think I do spearmint, but then there was a pineapple mint.
Yeah, there's an orange mint. Yeah.
An orange mint. There's all these different mints, but the pineapple one especially is, it's coming up in the grass.
Yep.
Yeah, I pull it, keep pulling it out where it got put, and I'm just shooting myself. But the peppermint I put on the northeast corner of my garage, and there's a tree that's there.
So it gets some shade.
So it's getting shade, and I never see it go to seed. And no, it doesn't spread very much. So I'm like, okay, I think if I want mint, this is what I've got to do is either put it in a bucket or some place where it's not going to get everything it wants.
And that's exactly right. If you give it a little bit of shade, and some of the mints aren't quite as aggressive, but even it, you'll notice it will start to grow out and it'll start to move. The pineapple mint, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that it was quite that aggressive.
I just have to tell you, it sucks. It's absolutely horrible. And then it's in an area that doesn't hardly get any water to it. And we keep trying to put we had strawberries that we replanted thinking, oh, we got rid of it. But pop, pop, pop.
Well, now you have the strawberry mint. You just combine them. And yeah, that's one of the problems with mint is it is somewhat aggressive. And I love mint. Don't get me wrong, but keep it confined. Keep it into its own little area. And it normally does better with a lot of water. When they grow it commercially, it's almost in a bog, if you will, very wet. And it just thrives in those areas. And that's why a lot of times we'll see it along stream banks, not so much in Utah, but in other locations. You'll see it where it's naturalized itself, and it just takes right off or along a stream bank.
So while we're on the subject of mint, what my mom always called horse mint, that seems to be the weed du jour in the garden. How do you get rid of it? Because it seems to grow not only from seed, but it's also growing from the roots.
How do you get rid of it? The best way is probably just to move.
And make sure you don't have any seeds with you as you leave.
Yeah, sterilize everything as you walk off the property. You know, there is no really easy way. There are some what we call some herbicides that you can use that'll control them, such, you know, the standards of glyphosate or Roundup and 2,4-D and those types of herbicides. The problem is it's like any other weed. One time doesn't do it, and you have to be consistent with it, and you have to keep working with it. And then if you see it in the summer, a lot of times we just tell you just to pull it and weaken the plant and then put something else in there. And then there are some plants that are just going to be hard to get rid of. And it's one of them. It's just hard to get rid of. And you just have to keep with it. And even when you keep with it, and we've talked about this before, Brian, some plants 3 years later was thrown down a seed and all of a sudden the seed will sprout and you think you've got it controlled and there it's back. And then you just have to keep working with it.
And then if you use canal water, good luck.
Anytime you're using some secondary water, there's a chance if you don't filter it really good, especially if you're using a canal or if you're flooding, yeah, you're going to get everything the neighbor let go to seed. And part of that, yeah, you just never know what they're going to let them go to seed.
So today's Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That plant is mint unless you put it in a bucket.
Correct.
Or on the northwest corner of your garage with a
with
tree.
Shade.
With shade. All right, Jerry, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That. Jerry Goodspeed is USU's Horticulture Extension Agent.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And for the next couple of times that I read, I would like to consider the matter of plants and politics. And I will be using some essays by Jamaica Kincaid, a sassy, opinionated woman who speaks her mind without any hesitation. She grew up in Antigua and somehow got to the States and was discovered by the New Yorker magazine, where she became one of the talk reporters. And her voice was strong and original. And so a lot of her talk pieces have been collected. This one from The New Yorker is called Alien Soil. Whatever it is in the character of the English people that leads them to obsessively order and shape their landscape to such a degree that it looks like a painting, tamed, framed, captured, kind, decent, good, pretty, while a painting never looks like the English landscape unless it's a bad painting, the quality of the character is blissfully lacking in the Antiguan people. When the English were a presence in Antigua, they first came to the island as slave owners when a man named Thomas Warner established a settlement there in 1632. The places where they lived were surrounded by severely trimmed hedges of plumbago, topiaries of willow, frangipani, hibiscus. Their grass was green. Odd, because water was scarce, the proper word for the climate is not sunny, but drought-ridden. And they kept trellises covered with roses and beds of marigolds and cannas and chrysanthemums. Ordinary Antiguans, and by ordinary Antiguan, I mean the Antiguan people who are descended from African slaves brought to this island by Europeans. This turns out to be a not uncommon way to become ordinary. When these people, the Antiguans, lived under the influence of the other people, the English, there was naturally an attempt among some of them to imitate their rulers in this particular way, by rearranging the landscape, and they did it without question. Then the English left, and most of their landscaping influence went with them, and then the Americans came, but the Americans, I am one now, are not interested in influencing people directly. We instinctively understand the childish principle of monkey see, monkey do. Thomas Jefferson, a great American gardener and our country's third president who owned slaves and strongly supported the idea of an expanded American border, which meant the extinction of the people who already lived on the land to be taken, while at the same time he was passionately devoted to ideas about freedom. What did the botanical life of Antigua consist of at the time of another famous adventurer, Christopher Columbus, when he first saw it? To see a garden in Antigua now will not supply a clue. I made a visit to Antigua this spring, and most of the plants I saw there came from somewhere else. The bougainvillea is native to tropical South America. The plumbago is from Southern Africa. The croton from Asia. The hibiscus from East Africa, and so on. What herb of beauty grew in this place then? What tree? And did the people who lived there grow anything beautiful for its own sake? I do not know. I can only make a straightforward deduction. The frangipani, the mahogany tree, and the cedar tree are all native to the West Indies, so these trees are probably indigenous. And some of the botany of Antigua can be learned from medicinal folklore. And then she tells about the chinaberry tree that her mother used to treat thrush in her children and that the children played with. And yet, the people of Antigua have a relationship to agriculture that does not please them at all. Their very arrival on this island had to do with forces of agriculture. When we, were brought to this island from Africa a few hundred years ago, it was not for pottery-making skills or way with the loom. It was for the free labor they could provide in the fields. An African woman born in Bermuda and spent part of her life as a slave in Antigua. And Henry Louis Gates writes of this, My master and mistress went on one occasion to the country of Date Hill for a change of air and carried me with them to take charge of the children and do the work of the house. While I was in the country, I saw the field Negroes working in Antigua. They worked very hard and were fed but scantily. They are called out to work before daybreak and come home after dark, and then each has to heave his bundle of grass for the cattle in the pen. Then on Sunday morning, each slave has to go out and gather a large bundle of grass, and when they bring it home, they have to sit at the manager's door and wait till he come out. Often they have to wait there till past 11 o'clock without any breakfast. After that, they have yams or potatoes, and hasten to market to buy salt fish or pork, which is a great treat for them. Perhaps it makes sense that a group of people with such wretched historical relationship to growing things would need to describe their current relationship as dignified and masterly, and would not find it poetic or pleasurable. In a book I am looking at, I find statements like this: the concept of a private garden planted purely for aesthetic purposes was generally alien to tropical countries, and there was no such tradition of horticulture among the inhabitants of hot weather places. And here a few questions occur to me. What if people living in the tropics, the ones whose history isn't tied up with and contaminated by slavery and indenturedness, are contented with their surroundings and happy to observe an invisible hand at work, and from time to time to laugh at some of the ugly choices it makes? When I was looking at a book of tropical gardens, I realized that the flowers and trees so familiar to me from my childhood do not now have a hold on me. I do not long to plant and be surrounded by bougainvillea. I do not like tropical hibiscus, so beautiful when tended, so ugly when left to itself, which makes everything around it look rusty and shabby, is not a plant I like at all. I returned from my visit to Antigua, the place where I was born, to a small village in Vermont, the place where I now choose to live. Spring had arrived, the tulips I had planted last autumn were in bloom, and I liked to sit and caress their petals, which felt disgustingly delicious, like scraps of pot de soie. The dizzy-making yellow of dandelions and cowslips that were in the fields and the river banks and marshes, I like these things. I do not like daffodils, but that's the legacy of the English. I was forced to memorize a poem by William Wordsworth when I was a child. And I'll just read you a little bit of this poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats high o'er the vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd of a host of golden daffodils beside a lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. I think that Jamaica Kincaid is really closer to this sentiment than she realizes, because a lot of her gardening takes place in her mind. In another essay, she says, "The reason I do not like daffodils is not at all aesthetic, but much more serious than that, having been forced to memorize a poem about daffodils when none were to be found naturally in the places where I grew up." She says in another essay, she was trying to make flower beds, and they were turning out to be odd shapes, odd in relation to the way flower beds usually look in a garden. I could see that they were odd, and I could see that they didn't look like the flower beds in gardens I admired, the gardens of my friends, the gardens portrayed in my books on gardening, but I couldn't help that. I wanted a garden that looked something like what I had in my mind's eye. But exactly what that might be, I did not know, and even now I don't know. And this must be why a garden for me is so bound up with words about the garden, with the words themselves. In a proper garden, they become much more difficult to explain to other gardeners who had more experience of a garden than I, and more of an established aesthetic of garden than I. "What is this?" I had been asked. "What are you trying to do here?" I have been asked, and sometimes I would reply by saying, I really don't know," or sometimes I would reply with absolute silence. When it dawned on me that the garden I was making, and am still making, and will always be making, resembled a map of the Caribbean, and the sea that surrounds it. I did not tell this to the gardeners who asked me to explain the thing I was doing or explain what I was trying to do. I only marveled at the way the garden for me is an exercise in memory, a way of remembering my own immediate past, a way of getting past to a past that is my own, the Caribbean Sea, and the past that is indirectly related to me. I think that this is the theme of what Nancy and I are doing, that words and gardens and gardeners and writers are in some interesting way connected. So we'll explore more of these ideas another time. Thank you. I'm so pleased to be able to do this, because it must be apparent that the subtext to everything that I do is that I love literature and I love gardens. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Helen Cannon is a regular contributor to The Zesty Garden, and she is a former English teacher at Utah State University and a lover of gardens and prose, and we appreciate her coming and doing this for us each week. In our gardening calendar, the Wasatch Community Gardens will host a workshop on seed saving on this Saturday, August 17th, from 1 to 3 at their Fruit Heights location. Learn how to select plants and vegetables to save seed from, and how saving your own seed is a vital part of becoming more self-efficient. Sufficient. Registration is required just at Wasatch Community Gardens, and that is at their website, wasatchgardens.org. The Utah Botanical Center will host a diagnostic clinic on Wednesday, August 21st from 3 to 6 at the Ogden Botanic Garden, 1750 Monroe Boulevard in Ogden. If you have any problems with trees and shrubs, lawns, vegetables, or flower gardens, the Master Gardeners can help. Information is at usubotanicalcenter.org. Thanksgiving Point is featuring a class on propagation by cutting Saturday, September 7th at 9 a.m. Discover how easy it is to propagate plants, and this is a great way to add to your plant collection for very little money. Information is at their website at thanksgivingpoint.com. The USU Extension Office in Cedar City will host a garden-to-table workshop Thursday, September 12th from 4 to 6 p.m. You'll learn tips for making the most of your garden through simple preservation methods. The workshop will cover a little bit of everything from homemade pizza to baby food. The Extension Office is at 585 North Main Street. Registration is required by calling 435-586-8132. And finally, there are gardeners and farmers markets around the state. The Wayne County Farmers Market is in Torrey. It sheets Saturday from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at 185 West Main Street. Garden City is hosting their market on Friday evenings from 5 to 8 at the parking lot north of the LDS Church on US 30, also known as Bear Lake Boulevard. The market runs through August. Stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to have a conversation about rainwater harvesting, but first, Melinda's gardening moment.
So it seems your perennial garden is filled with more weeds than flowers. Now is a great time to reclaim your garden by getting the weeds under control. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Ground ivy, bindweed, and quackgrass are a few perennial weeds that can quickly take over your garden. Continually pulling or cutting the weeds off at ground level may eventually kill the weeds, but you need to be more persistent than the weeds. You may want to try one of the eco-friendly weed and grass killers that use soaps, vinegar, and other organic products to burn off the tops of the plants. Repeat applications are needed. And be careful to protect your perennials, as these products can harm them as well. Remove the top and bottom of a milk jug. Cover the weed with the plastic jug. Then spray the weeds inside the milk jug with the vegetation killer. Allow it to drip dry before removing the jug. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's Richard II with seven other productions through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me for the rest of the hour, I have two guests. One is Brian Green. He's with USU's Department of Watershed Sciences and is coordinator for Utah Water Watch. And then I have landscape architect Kevin Jensen. He's with Three Men and a Shovel. And we're going to talk about rainwater harvesting. And I know several years ago, I guess it was illegal to harvest rainwater, which sounds a bit silly. But why don't you, Brian, talk about the history of rainwater harvesting and how things have changed in the last couple of years?
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. And it does seem kind of weird to people to actually think that out here in Utah, if you before 2010, if you collected rainwater that was coming off your roof or from on your property, that was actually illegal. And the reason behind that is in the West, we have what's called water rights. And so the governors and the people in power were afraid that that if everyone collected all the water that falls on your house has already been given to somebody else as like a farmer or a city. And so in 2010, they decided, well, we can actually, if people, you know, capture some of it, they're not keeping it forever. They're just going to keep it for a little while and use it on their lawn or their garden. So in 2010, they made rainwater harvesting, which we commonly refer to as like rain barrels, here in Utah legal. And in 2013, they actually updated the law to make it a little bit simpler about what the regulations and guidelines are.
Okay, so let's talk about what those regulations and guidelines are before moving into, okay, what do you use this water for in the first place? So rain falls, it's August, and we get a thunderstorm that comes through, and a quarter inch of water hits your roof. And so how do you collect that water, and how much of it can you collect?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, you're trying to capture the rain that's coming off your roof or any structure. Generally, they come through your downspouts. For example, if you have a 1,000-square-foot roof and a quarter inch of rain, you're going to get around 130 gallons that's going to come off in that one event. So in Utah, the regulations now are you can store up to 2,500 gallons. So 2,500 gallons of rain water can be stored in a container, either above or below ground. And you can have as many containers as you want. You can store them in different ways. And the only regulations that there are is you need to register online. There's a free online registration that's done through the Division of Water Rights that if you need to register, if you have more than two covered containers or if any container is greater than 100 gallons in size. So if you just have two 50-gallon drums around your house, you don't need to register anything with the state. You can put them out there. It's easy to go. But if you want to have a bigger system, say put in a 1,000-gallon system, all you need to do is go on this website, just type in your name, your address, and tell them how much water you're storing, and that's it.
Okay, why do we even have to register in the first place? This just seems silly to me. But you'll explain that. But I'm just thinking, okay, that this is my property. The water's going to be going back into the soil anyway. This is a state where the legislature is always saying they don't want to regulate people, but then we have this. Why do we have to have the regulation?
I think the legislators wanted to do this for two reasons. One, they wanted to see how rapidly this was going to be taken up by people. And so this is kind of a way of measuring, okay, how profuse is this in our state? How many people are going to adopt this helpful green infrastructure? So they kind of want to be able to track that. And two, it does help them plan. You know, if all of a sudden every single person, you know, in a small area was collecting 2,500 gallons, it could have a small effect on the amount of water going back into our streams and lakes. But they decided that actually, in reality, the water that these people are collecting, they're just going to use for a little bit, and then they're going to put it back on their gardens, they're going to put it back on their landscape, and it's actually going to come out cleaner and at a more natural pace that downstream users like farmers and other cities are going to get the benefits from. So it's actually something that benefits them.
Okay, I need to make sure I give out our phone number. If you have any questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment or question there as well. All right, so typically, what are you going to use this water for? It's not potable. You're not going to drink it because it was coming off of your roof.
Yeah, this is not water that you can drink. And so this is generally water that you're going to use outdoors. You can put it on your plants. It's not treated with any, you know, chemicals, you know, when it's coming off. It doesn't have any chlorine. It's sometimes in our residual water treatment systems. And it is used for landscape watering, irrigation. You can also use it for cleaning, you know, cleaning your garden tools, you know, cleaning around your house, and then put that water back out on your landscape.
Is the water that falls typically a little more acidified than we normally get out of the tap?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting thing. Rainwater coming either as snow or just regular rain is actually a little bit more acidic than water you get out from a stream or you get from a tap water. That's because through the process of burning things, fossil fuels, and we release what we call like nitric oxide and sulfuric oxide, and up in the atmosphere they react and they create sulfuric and nitric oxide. So we have a little bit lowered pH when it's coming out of rain water.
I mean, I can see this being useful if you have a strawberry garden or if you have raspberries. And where I live, I haven't tested the pH, but I've got a pretty good guess it's higher than when I lived in Mendon or when I was living in River Heights, because things that didn't yellow in those other two locations get yellow and get the iron chlorotic problem that I have currently. So I can see, I don't know if it would make that much of a difference, but I can see using it at least for plants that like to have a little bit lower pH.
I know there are some people that actually, there's one reason why they collect rainwater is to use on specific plants because they know it's not been treated. It doesn't have, you know, things like common things that we get in our water, like fluoride or like chlorine. And so some people do prefer it to put it on their plants.
It's typically a softer water too.
Yep.
So you'll get less of the calcium buildup that can be associated with potable water from a municipal source.
Okay. So what's the typical setup? What do most people do? I'm thinking, okay, I'm a homeowner. I don't have anything. How do I get started?
So for doing a rain barrel, there's literally a lot of options. And you can go from very simple things that you do yourself, such as, you know, putting in a small, you know, 55-gallon blue drum that you know, got somewhere. Or, you know, there are many custom designed ones. You can get barrels made from, you know, like a real wooden barrel or a terracotta barrel, or up to a large, you know, 1,000-gallon, you know, system, or 2,500-gallon system. It's a very large, you know, barrel that you have to buy from a specialty supplier.
I saw one online that actually had it looked like a flower pot because it had plants growing out of the top of it, and I thought, okay, that's aesthetically pleasing instead of having just a big blue barrel sitting on the corner of the house.
There are lots of different design options where you incorporate plants growing into the barrels and different things, and that look really good. You know, so it depends on, you know, what your style is and how you like. You can go anywhere from, you know, cheap and easy, you get in probably a $20-$30 used plastic barrel, to paying up to $1,000 for,
right,
you know, really well aesthetically pleasing designed barrels.
Design options are always endless.
Yes.
You know, from salvage and scrap materials to saw a cool one that was the foundation of a deck. It was all concrete cistern for holding harvested rainwater.
Okay, let's talk about cost then. I could imagine a 2,500-gallon container not exactly being cheap. And if you're trying to come out ahead, you're going to be dead before that actually happens, at least with the cost of water right now.
Yeah. One of the things that we'll talk about is these things are good for both water conservation and water quality. We'll talk a little bit, I'm sure, later about this green infrastructure and why we're doing this in the broader environmental sense. But as far as a return on your investment, if you think you're going to put in a 50-gallon rain barrel and you're never going to have to water your lawn again, that's probably not true. And if you also think, I'm going to go out and spend $10,000 on a 2,500-gallon system with a pump and, you know, do my whole yard, that this is going to pay for itself in, you know, 2 years, that's not really true. You know, if you think about it, we have some of the cheapest water in the nation here in Utah, and so I get 1,000 gallons.
Which is kind of bizarre, with we're the second driest state.
It is. Some people think it is a little bit of a paradox, you know, but one, we have really clean water. You know, we have a really good water source that comes from our mountains and from our snowpack. And two, we've had a lot of infrastructure that was put in place. You know, we're benefiting from all the hard work our, you know, forefathers did, you know, generations ago. Now we are going to have to update a lot of these things, and you constantly hear about new canals having to be built, and you know, water prices we know are going to rise in Utah. And so this water, this is a, you put in a rain barrel for lots of reasons. You know, one of them is water conservation, one of them is, you know, you are going to save a little bit of money, but I think the larger reason is you want to help the environment, and you want to create a nice attractive landscape around your garden, around your home.
And it's water that's hitting your home that's just not being used. I mean, for most people, it's just going down the spout, and it's washing out a few plants if you're lucky, and it's something that you could be using for some kind of a garden.
Certainly.
So let's talk about a little bit of what kind of gardens would you use this for?
Well, one of the most typical gardens or ways to use rainwater is through a landscape feature called a rain garden. And a rain garden has many different names, comes in many different shapes and sizes, and can be applied from a city watershed scale to right down to something in your backyard, as simple as disconnecting your downspouts, taking the water that flows from your downspout and directing it into a shallow basin in your landscape that is essentially there to collect and hold this rainwater. In conjunction with that basin, you can have very nice aesthetic plantings, create a whole design theme around the movement of the water in your landscape. And to build on what Brian was saying as to you know why people should do it, it's another reason is it's a really good way for community members like you and me to be actively involved in watershed and stormwater management within the places that we live. So when you have these features in your landscape, when you have a rain barrel that you're using that water from, or when you divert the water into a rain garden, you're more of an active steward of your watershed. You're helping to control the flow of that runoff within your watershed. So you're reducing peak flows, and you can also use that in a beneficial way to some people grow food in rain gardens. Pollinator rain gardens are very popular. So you're adding a biodiversity to our watershed at the same time.
So how easy is this to adapt for your home? You talk about you have the downspouts. Is this something that you connect to your own downspout, or do you have to put in something new?
Typically, a rain garden is it can be either way. Typically, a rain garden is receives runoff from your downspout, and that can come in a pipe that runs above ground or below ground and feeds your rain garden. Or it can be through a swale or a shallow, I don't like to say ditch, but it's essentially a ditch. a swale is another way to get rainwater into your garden. And so it's, I wouldn't say directly connected, but there's a direct feed of rainwater there from your roof to your garden.
So if you use a swale, does that count, because you don't really have a container, does that count toward having 100 gallons, or are you just directing it?
That wouldn't go against towards your 100-gallon, you know, it wouldn't count towards your limit of 2,500 gallons. The regulation is just for what you're containing. So it has to be in some type of, you know, vessel that you're storing the water. A rain garden is a more, you know, passive one where it's going to go into the garden and go into the ground more quickly. A rain barrel, you're storing that for maybe later use. Because if you think about it, you know, do you really need to water your garden that day that it rained? You know, you're going to store that water for maybe next week or 2 weeks later. And so then you can, you know, use a little bit of it further on.
What are the most effective types of containers? I mean, you talked about terracotta, you talked about wooden. What do you see as being the most efficient?
The only thing that we have two general recommendations that we make. One is that whatever your source, a lot of people like to do this on their own, just find a barrel from some source, is that you want to make sure that whatever is being stored in that barrel beforehand is not something that's going to hurt your plants. You know, so make sure it's really clean and a good source. We don't recommend metal barrels because obviously they're going to rust. And The other thing we recommend here in Utah, especially in our colder parts of our listening areas where we get winter and we freeze, is putting in what's called a diverter on your rain spout. So many people think like, oh, I'm going to put out this rain barrel. I'm just going to cut my downspout and stick a barrel underneath. And that's one option that people do. But then in the wintertime when, you know, you want to empty that barrel, because if it freezes, you know, you're going to have this giant 55-gallon frozen ice block that's going to be there. And actually, they can weigh a lot. You know, if you're getting 50 gallons of water at 8 pounds a gallon, that's 400 pounds. So that's a pretty heavy thing that you want to make sure it's, you know, stable in a good place. So we actually recommend that people disconnect them in the wintertime, drain all the water out of them, you know, flip them upside down. And so by putting in this diverter, it's a device that fits right in your downspout that lets the water, when it rains, come down, go into the rain barrel. But then if the rain barrel is going to overflow or top off, or like leaves and different things, it just sends them right down the downspout. So your downspout's still there. It's still moving water away from your house like it's intended to do. You're just capturing some of that rain when you need to. And they seem to work really effectively.
And I also wanted to talk about, of course, the plants. What kind of plants are you looking at? I guess it depends on what you want to do with that water. But for someone who just doesn't quite know what direction to go, what would you recommend, Kevin?
Certainly. Well, the plant palette specific to rain gardens is an evolving list here in Utah. There's been extensive research done for different more mesic regions of the United States, specifically in the eastern U.S. and the Northwest, where they get large amounts of rainfall, and not a lot of that data is applicable to our plants. However, there are some plants that share the same characteristics, but it's a pretty specific plant palette because you need plants that can sustain periods of drought, so drought-tolerant plants, but then you also need plants that can sustain periods of inundation and having their feet wet for a little while.
So let me back up a minute. Why would you install be a rainwater harvester if you're getting 40 inches of water, if you're back east and everything's green anyway? Why would you install this? Is it just because you want to make sure that what goes back into the environment is cleaner?
Well, actually, in some of the cities of the east, my experience is coming from the city of Philadelphia, where I was working, and they've actually been mandated by the EPA. They have a watershed protection plan in place. And the rain gardens, or bioretention, they're kind of synonymous terms. It's a common approach where the rain gardens essentially can act as the kidneys or the filters for the landscape. So you take think outside of your residence on a city scale, all of that water that runs across a parking lot and picks up the oils and the brake dust and all of the contaminants that settle in between storms on a parking lot. That first flush, as it's called, the first 1 inch of water that hits that parking lot is directed into a rain garden, where that water then settles, percolates through the soil. That soil is an engineered medium, typically a combination of topsoil and a gravel substrate, where that water can filter through there and actually remove chemicals and particulates. You can get some anaerobic processes that happen there as well. So that first flush of water is cleaned before that water is sent into the city's storm system. So they're the kidneys of the landscape. And then also back there, it's a form of passive irrigation, the same as it is here, but they get more reliable rainfall there. So
do you see this? It's more of an eastern thing, and it's just now getting out to the west?
Yeah, I think, you know, their need came more from the amount of water that they have.
Well, I can imagine a huge city like Philadelphia and how much blacktop there would be.
Lots of impervious surfaces, a lot of, you know, Utah is one of the fastest growing states in the nation. We're going to have more urbanization, a lot more porous land, a lot more green space is going to be converted into impervious surface, be it roads, rooftops, all of the above, even turf areas in your landscape are pretty compacted surfaces. And so it is slowly disseminating into, you know, our region. And the logic goes, well, they have so much water out there. Out here, Why do we need to do that? And it's like I was alluding to earlier, it's a way for homeowners to be more of an active watershed steward. You can help. You can have these kidneys of the landscape, the filters in your own yard before. So whatever lands on your yard is going to be cleaned a little bit and released more slowly into the storm system than your neighbor who the water just hits his driveway and runs right into the curb and gutter. So it helps with peak flow. And actually in the east, a rain barrel, something as simple as that, it's a pretty small amount for a volume of water comparatively to the amount of rain they're getting. But here in the west where we get quite a bit less rainfall, a rain barrel is actually a really good way to slow down peak flows in the U.S.
Because in the summer, we don't get a lot, but when we get it, it usually comes a lot all at once with a thunderstorm or something.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and when all that water enters our streams and waterways, it carries with it a lot of sediments, a lot of particulates that can damage our waters and cause erosion because of the increased flow in our streamways.
Yeah, so for some people, it's actually, you know, counterintuitive, especially out here, you know, we think, how can rain be bad? You know, every time it rains, I'm so happy, you know, and my garden's so happy. But this storm water is actually can be a big negative effect on the water quality of our streams and of our lakes. And so, you know, if you think about how it used to, you know, before we had all this impervious surface, before we built our houses and things like this, you know, it used to rain out on the forest or out on the sagebrush, and the water would slowly percolate, you know, through the ground, and it would get filtered out, and then it would go back, you know, in a slow process, kind of like a sponge, you know, soaks it up and then slowly releases it, so we have more water for later on. Well, now when we build up all this impervious areas, you know, the water hits my roof, goes in my gutter, it goes down in the storm drain, picks up, you know, all the dirt and things that are in there, the trash, and moves it right into the stream. And so that process happens a lot faster. And so it's, you know, it can bring a lot of pollutants that can negatively affect our environment. And like Kevin was saying, you know, out here in the West, we don't get a lot of rain, as much rain as back in east, but we can actually capture a lot more of it. I work with a group here in Utah that's called iUtah, that they actually a group of researchers who are studying how water moves. And there's a specific group of them that studies green infrastructure. And they just put out a research paper that said in Salt Lake City that if putting one 50-gallon barrel at your house would be able to capture 68% of the rainwater that's coming off of it in a normal rain year. Mm. And that if everybody in your neighborhood, you know, and they modeled this from some researchers at the University of Utah, they modeled a neighborhood in Salt Lake City, that if 100 houses did this, that they would reduce their stormwater impact, the amount of water that runs off their land, by 12%.
Wow.
That's significant.
That's really high. I was thinking of a former neighbor that I had that was into biome remediation and how it cleans up the water when you plant certain things. Like he liked to plant a lot of willows, which now are starting to get into my garden. But anyway, he just had extra plants. But he would go to a site that had a lot of toxic chemicals and things in the ground, and not only were bacteria eating these things and ingesting them, but the things like corn and the willows were uptaking things and getting them out of the soil. And then like with the corn, they were able to harvest gold because they were getting just little particles of gold. The plant would uptake it, and then they could harvest the corn.
Wow.
The plant, and enough of it was happening, they were getting that back. So I can imagine, at least in your own yard, you're not going to be harvesting any gold or anything, but that the plants that you put in have a significant impact on that water getting back into the table and how clean it is.
Sure. And that's I know the willows are pretty commonly used in bioremediation, phytoremediation. They uptake a lot and can pull that out of the water.
Well, we have about 9 minutes left of the program. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can comment or post a question on the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. We'll be looking there as well. So let's talk about some of the plants that are going to be going in. And we talked a little bit before the program about some of these, and I get excited about them because I've got a few of them in my own yard that I just love to have. And one of those was the hyssop. I love it because it gives later flowering in through the summer. So it started up about first part of July, and now it's going to keep blooming until the end of the year. But let's talk about these plants.
Yeah, anytime that you can use natives in the landscape, and especially that's no exception for rain gardens. Natives can really help increase the biodiversity. There's some that are pretty well suited. Little blue stem grass, the Idaho fescue, or a couple grasses. A lot of research has been done on East Coast plants, but we're still developing this region's plants. But Apache plume is a good one on the native list. Goldenrod. A lot of the natives that are kind of appropriate are more of the shrub level, so kind of that mid level of plants. Rubber rabbit brush, fragrant sumac. Is one that we're trying out. Dogwoods do great in the drought and can withstand
that
standing water.
So are you talking more like Radosier dogwood or more of the traditional dogwoods from back east? Because I know you can grow a Coosa dogwood here, but you're thinking more shrub-like?
More shrub-like, yeah. Okay. It depends on the space that you have and what you're trying to accomplish. Just like garden design, I should say that the list that we have, there's a common misconception, I think, with natives that it's just one and done, plant it and forget it, and they don't need watered, and they do need water. They need a full year of regular watering to establish their roots. The roots are really important in a rain garden to help with that infiltration of the water into the soil, and so the natives, they need to be watered, and I think they need to be watered to be established, and then they also need periodic watering throughout the summer as well. There's a difference between just holding on and surviving and actually looking good and meeting people's expectation of what they should look like. And if we want natives to be more accepted in the landscape, I think that we kind of have to get past the perception that they don't need supplemental water. They don't need nearly as much supplemental water as a lot of the prevalent plants. But then in addition to the natives, I like a nice mix of natives and then some of the more available drought-tolerant nursery stock, such as a lot of the penstemons that we have. I mean, that's another native, but the Whipple penstemon would perform. And Strictus, the Rocky Mountain penstemon, is one that we've used in rain gardens.
What about firecracker?
Firecracker, penstemon? Yeah, up on the rim of the rain garden, where it's not sitting down in the bottom of the basin in the standing water. Yarrow, sedums are amazing rain garden plants. Anytime you see a green roof, it's typically most of the composition is sedums, and that's because they're so resilient to long periods of dry drought.
Is it considered a succulent?
I
mean, it does have has a thicker leaf to it, so
yeah,
it seems like it. And the ones that I've got at my home don't mind being overwatered whatsoever. So unlike a cactus, a succulent that doesn't want to get that extra water a lot, sedums do work quite well.
Right, and the autumn joy, the taller sedum could go up. Well, it could go in the bottom of the basin as well as up on the perimeter. But when siting your plants, you need to think about that. The plants on the bottom of the basin in the bottom of the garden are going to be in standing water for longer periods of time than those that are kind of up on the rim of the basin.
I can imagine that when you're putting in these gardens, that if a regular homeowner doesn't want to have to amend the soil a whole bunch, they just want to be able to put it in easy enough. So are some of these more acceptable of being moved and planted and soil conditions than others?
Yeah, definitely. To go back to the sedums are one that you can just basically take a handful of sedum and throw them out and they grow on their own. You know, another good one that's used a lot is I lost my train of thought there. The butterfly milkweed, Asclepias. That's another common one that's used.
You mean just like
used.
That monarchs?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So yeah. I wanted to put one of those in because we always go out looking for monarch caterpillars to hatch them in the house.
So. Uh-huh. those work on the bottom of on rain gardens. We've seen those in Philadelphia, and they're also well adapted to the drought here. Tulips. And irises, you can get your bulbs in there as well.
So, you know, iris rhizomes, I was just planting some in the Uinta Basin yesterday, took some out for something work-related, and she wanted to know, well, how much water? I said, well, you've got to water them about once a week or so to keep them, to get them established. But iris are one of those, if you don't want to do anything with them, they'll just keep growing. They'll flower better if you take care of them a little more, but that goes back to what you were saying before.
Yeah.
Whatever your expectations are. Well, a Russian sage is going to keep growing, but it's going to look a lot better if you give it some supplemental water.
Absolutely. I think that's the case with the majority of plants in general. You know, they're living entities and they like to have routine water just like you and I do.
We've got just about 2 minutes left. So what's going to be the easiest way for someone to get started? And I need to mention, I forgot to mention you, Brian Green is here. He's from the USU Department of Watershed Science, and he's coordinator with Utah Water Watch. And Kevin Green is a licensed landscape architect with Three Men and a Shovel. So how does someone get started? Where do they go for information?
I think the main thing that we want to put out there is that this is something that anyone can do. It's, you know, you can choose a level that you're comfortable with, and you can start off small and, you know, start building bigger. There's lots of resources online. If you want to come to our extension.usu.edu water quality webpage, you can see about rain barrels and how to build them. And you can always call somebody like Kevin Jensen and give him a call if you for your help of doing designing a more elaborate rain garden.
Does Utah Water Watch have it's a Facebook page, isn't it?
We have a Facebook page. We're on Facebook, Utah Water Watch. We're also on Twitter at Utah Water Watch. So if you have any questions, you can send them to us there.
Okay. And Kevin, what would you suggest?
For rain gardens, this is really just a quick rundown on them. But rain gardens, the sizing and everything, there's really good literature online. There's a good book that I found that's more tailored to the residential site, a good do-it-yourself book called Creating Rain Gardens. I think Wolf is the author on that. But Creating Rain Gardens is a good book resource. There's a good website. If you look up One Drop at a Time, -168 Elm. If you do One Drop at a Time, you get a lot of different results. Do One Drop at a Time, -168 Elm. That's a really good residential resource for the things that we're talking about. And then artfulrainwaterdesign.net is a really good one that's out of Penn State with my former grad school advisor.
Well, thank you to both for coming in. I appreciate the conversation about rainwater harvesting.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure. Yeah.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brian Green from the USU Department of Watershed Sciences and coordinator with Utah Water Watch has been in studio. And Kevin Jensen, a licensed landscape architect with Three Men and a Shovel, has also been in here. Thanks again.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.